Good evening, and thank you all parties for standing by. Your lines will be on a listen-only until the question and answer session of today's conference call. The call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to turn today's conference over to Ms. Vivian White. Thank you, ma'am. You may begin.
Thank you. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight. We're so glad you've decided to spend the next hour with us. This is Vivian White, talking with you from the Night Sky Network headquarters here in San Francisco, and I'd like to welcome you all to a very special teleconference. We're here tonight to talk about an important resource to all of us, our dark skies. We'll be learning about some about the problem itself and how to make the public aware of the issue. But first, as our tradition stands, let's see who's on the line with us. When the operator opens up the lines, could you just let us know your name and where you're calling in from? Operator, would you open the lines when you have a chance?
Thank you. One moment.
Maria Schweitzer from
George
the Ruby
Norman
Thompson
from Binghamton, New York.
In Colorado.
Ms. Dorsey,
Roy Trostle, Abingdon, Maryland.
Jewel Carpel from Albuquerque, New Mexico.
Ezra Gillum from Salisbury, North Carolina.
Kier Ryan Group from Tennessee.
Herb Gidman from Salisbury, North Carolina.
Hey, John Pasmino, New York.
Alan Jones-Chain.
Processing.
Barb Hubble, Mansfield, Ohio.
Aaron Grabowski, Norman, Oklahoma.
Carolyn Ramirez from Wichita, Kansas.
Kathy DeSantis, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Wacko, Bellingham, Washington.
Dennis Erickson,
Tom
Chicago,
Dorsey.
Illinois.
Ron Kunkel, Reading, Pennsylvania.
Barnard Seifert, Astronomical Society, Nashville, Tennessee.
Southern Virginia Astronomy Club.
Larry Robinson with the Orion Group in Oak Ridge.
Roy Trostle from the Harford County Astronomical Society.
Yes.
Alan Mowick. Morgan County Observatory, West Virginia.
Jewel Carpel was from the Albuquerque, New Mexico TAS, T-A-A-S Club.
Hi. Jacqueline Duch from the South Bay Astronomy Club in Los Angeles suburbs.
John Gallagher from the Hawaiian Astronomical Society.
John Minoni, Bernard Astronomical
Texas
Society, Niota, Tennessee.
Ken Lund from the South Bay Astronomical Society and Long Beach.
Bill McFadden, Statesboro Astronomy Club.
Tammy Plotner, Warren Rupp Observatory, Mansfield, Ohio.
Yay!
Aaron Hahn from the Orion Group.
Sherry Adams, Dayton, Ohio, with the Miami Valley Astronomical Society.
All right.
Donna Fudge, Orion Group in Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Christine Graham, Orion Group, Oak Ridge, Tennessee.
Hi.
Skip Bird with the Westminster Astronomy Club, Westminster, Maryland.
Hey, Skip.
That Square wasn't on there anymore. Remember a long time.
All right.
My name's Leek. I'm at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. I'm with the Warner Springs Ranch Stargazing Group.
All right.
Belinda. And also Joyce Napier, Des Moines Astronomical Society, Des Moines, Iowa.
Tom Dorsey, California. Bellingham, Washington, Whatcom Association of Celestial Observers.
Bill and Melinda Lord, Bernard Astronomical Society, and Orion.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
Jim Hatch, Astronomical Society of Northern New England.
Belinda Lee from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
All right.
Rob Burgess from Brunswick, Maine.
Robert Bobby Sellers from Ogilvy Astronomy Club in Ewing, West Virginia.
Rizomba.
One moment, please.
That's Pablo Market, Michigan.
Everybody's logging in.
Great. That's a wonderful turnout. The country is very well represented, it sounds like. Yes, are we all set?
Yes.
Everyone is back on mute.
All right. Thank you all so much. It's really, really great to hear from so many of you. 20 of the clubs that are calling in tonight have already won the Globe Night Sky, the Night Outreach kit, including the sky quality meters. And there will be some instructions on that towards the end of the talk. But most of what's covered tonight can be used by everybody. And so also remember at the end of the Q&A period following the presentation, we'll be giving away 5 more kits to clubs that have not previously won one. So be sure to stick around for that. And one more quick note as we start talking about light conservation. another opportunity to educate the public about dark skies. The National Dark Sky Week has just been announced. You can find more information on it on the discussion board under announcements, and keep an eye out for more information as well in an upcoming newsletter. So now I have the pleasure of quickly introducing our speakers for this evening and let them get started with their talk. First, we have Connie Walker, who was trained as an astronomer, but now by trade, she's a science education specialist with the National Optical Astronomy Observatory in Tucson, Arizona. She has also recently been asked to chair both the U.S. and global working groups on dark sky awareness for the upcoming International Year of Astronomy, which is coming up next year in 2009. Also joining us tonight, many of you probably remember Chuck Buter from the work he did with the transit of Venus in 2004. I first was aware of him through the acclaimed Paper Plate Education website, which has wonderful activities. He's now directing his considerable talents towards the campaign for light conservation. And he's calling in from South Bend, Indiana. He's a member of the Michiana Astronomical Society. So we would like to welcome the two of the hardest working dark sky crusaders around. Thank you two both for joining us.
Thank you very much,
Vivian. I really appreciate it. Well, we're going to start off by tag teaming, and we have about a 40 slide presentation here, and we're hoping that by the end of it, you will get so riled up that you'll just want to go out tonight, right after the conference here, and look up at your night sky and take your measurements. And usually when I address the astronomy clubs, especially there's a big one here in town in Tucson, one of the first things I ask when I try to advocate for Globe at Night is if you prefer to, you know, when you go out with your telescope, if you do prefer a dark site to observe. And, of course, all the hands go up, yay. And I can't see your hands tonight, and I can't even hear you tonight. So, but it's something to consider in terms of trying to preserve the dark skies for generations to come. It's a heritage that we want to be able to pass on. And it's not a very difficult thing to do. So tonight we're trying to advocate for you to become local leaders in dark sky conservation. Okay. And when we look at the second slide here, we see what I like to fondly call, and I'm being a little sarcastic here, our urban constellations. And places like the eastern half of the United States and most of Europe and, of course, off the shores of Japan, you're not quite able, as you can in the darker sites, to see the stellar constellations. So, again, a heritage we're losing. So we can attack this global problem with local solutions, and we're going to talk about that tonight. In particular, on slide 3, when you're talking to your public, I know most of you are very much aware of light pollution and know quite a bit about it, but you want to convey to them why we do care, how they can participate in minimizing light pollution, how do we go about measuring it, and how do we expand the citizen scientist experience to them. And then if they're really interested, and I know you are, how can we be involved in an International Year of Astronomy? So this is something to keep in mind as we go through the slides here. Now, on slide 4, this is what we're going to discuss tonight. We'd like to briefly touch on the different types of light pollution, say a little bit about lighting, talk about briefly the light pollution education kits, because these kits, although they're fairly effective, it's nothing that all of you cannot create. And I mean, what I mean by that is the all the other groups other than the 25 who will be receiving the kits or already have received the kits. And then we'll talk a little bit about shielding and how you can demonstrate this to the public, and go into the classic version, that is the unaided eye version of Globe at Night, and talk a little bit more about the digital version of Globe at Night, which uses the sky quality meters, and then have one slide on the International Year of Astronomy and how you can find out more about it. So now I'd like to turn over the next few slides to Chuck.
Good evening, everybody, and I'm so happy that there are so many of you out there, and it's good to know that you are not alone in hearing all those voices, because sometimes it can seem like a lonely battle out there. But there are a lot of advocates in the dark that are out there willing to help you. I just briefly want to talk on the three aspects of light pollution. I don't want to get too much terminology whenever I'm talking to the public, but there are three basic aspects that we want to look at, the first being glare. And glare is when you can see that direct light source. It's not shielded in any way, and you're almost looking right at the filament itself. And when you're talking to different audiences, you usually have to target your conversation to who is listening. So glare, for example, might be a topic that you'll focus on when you're talking to a city planner, because they are concerned about issues like pedestrian and motorist safety. So in this image here that we have on slide 5 with the glare creates a veil of light across your entire field of view. And for motorist pedestrian safety, that's quite an issue, because underneath that stop sign that's shown there, it says cross traffic does not stop. So that could be an issue in this example. Next is light trespass, a form of spillover. Spillover light being the light that goes beyond its target, such as a billboard. You know, you hit the billboard, you light it up, but then there's all the light that goes beyond it. And when that spillover goes beyond property lines, for example, it's referred to as light trespass. And this is an issue for a lot of people, again, when you're targeting your audience, when you're speaking to maybe a homeowners association or a community group. And then the third form of light pollution is sky glow, which the astronomy community, of which most of you belong, are so familiar. And sky glow is an important issue, and astronomers are no longer the only ones that are leading this charge here. Astronomers have been the bell ringers of this thing, the canaries in the coal mine. It's the role of astronomers to look up at the sky and to measure and quantify and observe it. And we look at it, so we're among the first to notice there's an issue here. So sky glow is endearing. It's a dear topic to the hearts of those who have an astronomy bent, but not everybody is going to be embracing this astronomy. So make sure you just kind of target your audience to the. Again, I'm just kind of scooting through some of these. The example of the car lot shows two scenarios. You've got the overlighted one and the reasonably lighted one, where there's sufficient lighting. And that's one of the key things. We're not trying to tell businesses that they can't light up the business. If we're suggesting that they light it up wisely and use sufficient light. A little caveat if you're going to be using any pictures in a public presentation, such as the one with this car dealership, you want to be careful about using an image that's too overexposed, because it might look like you are adjusting the gain or just over-exaggerating the condition. But this does have the value. Picking a topic like a car lot does show that even seemingly common offenders, such as automobile dealerships, can have good lighting and can be leaders in good lighting. So you can't look at them as the enemy, because they can be leaders in the community. Moving on to slide 9, we've got 9 and 10 as a pair of scenes in which a pedestrian is in an illuminated walkway preparing to cross a street and appears at a guard station where cars are going to be accelerating out of a dark area. There's a significant amount of glare. There's a lot of lighting. There's more lighting in the upper half of this picture in the trees than there is in other areas. If you overlight, you start creating shadows, and those actually is a security issue that comes up, because people can't be seen in the shadows, whether it's someone trying to cross the street or if it's your villain in the night who can hide in the shadows. Going from slides 9 to 10, just rock back and forth between those two images, and you can see that the pedestrian is disappearing as they walk into the shadow that's cast by the light. There's no problem with having plenty of light along the walkway and on the edges of it, but you don't need the excess light that's up in the trees there, that glare that creates a veil across your field of view and is creating excess shadows. So quality lighting it's going to maximize the desired effects by minimizing the adverse effects. So it's, you know, these are obvious, and I don't want to be preaching to the choir here, but we want to decrease glare, light trespass, and sky glow. And these are all win-win situations for everybody. You increase safety and security. You conserve energy. There's the issue of animal habitats. Human health issues are just starting to emerge, where certain things like the, you know, the production of melatonin in the human body goes on only at night. There's almost an absence of it during the day, and yet if you were looking at melatonin production in the human body, if you were to turn on a bright light for a sustained time and then turn it back off, it absolutely shuts down the production of melatonin, which is critical for you know, preventing things like breast cancer. So there are certain human health issues that are just emerging. I'm not going to say I cite them very often, but just want you to be aware of them and keep an eye out for them. And plus, there's just a, you know, it says a good nighttime ambience. There's a quality of life issue, and a quality of life issue as well here. So there are many diverse reasons for having quality lighting, and not just for the benefit of the astronomy community. So our keys to quality lighting are going to be to, we want to see the effect of the light, not the source. And if it's to light up somebody's billboard, that's fine. But let's, you know, shine the light down, eliminate the glare, don't show us the source, and light where it's needed. You want to have sufficient light, but not excess or errant lighting. So don't overlight. And another thing is, when people, you know, we're in the midst of a bunch of people switching out to CFLs, these compact fluorescent lights. When you get your community to swap out a bunch of CFLs, it's a good time to address other lightings. They've got their hand on a light bulb before they even purchase that CFL. For example, on your, if you have a lamp post outside, suggest they not only get a CFL, but get one of a lower lumen output at the same time. Get two birds with one stone. Have fewer lumens and lower wattage. Moving on to the diagram of the unshielded fixture. If some of you have tried that at a little demonstration, you get the mini flashlight, you take off the hood of the light, and you just hold it with that bare exposed light bulb showing. This demonstration, I heard there are a couple people, for example, from the planetarium community, but that demonstration can be used in an office room if you want. I just did it in a superintendent's office this afternoon. It doesn't have to be, you know, a fancy room. But that light, when you hold it, very much mimics this diagram of an unshielded fixture. Not only is it throwing light in all directions, but don't ignore the opportunity to use that shadow that's right at the base of it. When we talk about that demonstration later, I often put a little figurine right up against the post in the shadow of it, and it won't show up because it does indeed cast this dark cone of light. So the unshielded fixture is strictly going up, lighting up the bellies of birds and bats and airplanes and the bottoms of clouds. And you know, that's also, I was talking about targeting your audience, that's definitely one when I'm talking to somebody on a city council. It's tax dollars. If, you know, nearly half of your tax dollars for your city's light fixtures are being wasted, then you'll have the ear of someone who's holding the purse strings, like a council member. When we then look at the shielded fixture, slide 14, We're knocking off all the sins. You're minimizing the glare because you do not see that direct light source. You minimize the light directed out upward because it's got that horizontal cutoff. That minimizes light trespass because you're not typically the brightest light is going to be closer to the post itself, and you're controlling the light output. So the shielded fixture, if I could say, you know, if there was one magic bullet, there isn't. You know, turn the lights off as the magic bullet. But the next greatest thing you could do if you have to get one message across is to use fully shielded fixtures. The next two show, you know, slides 15 and 16 are the same scenes, a building. Those lights that can be angled, if you're going to have any lighting ordinances, make sure any hinged lights are always horizontal, require that they be horizontal. You know, the first one shows how that light is going upward above the horizontal. Notice that on the second image on slide 16, you supplement the entrance light perhaps. Left and right, you can see there's some lighting underneath that canopy. But the overall effect is to absolutely eliminate the sky glow. So that's my introduction to some lighting issues. Connie will now introduce the Globe at Night Light Pollution Education Kit.
Also, some sound bites you can use with the public are that up to about $10 billion in the U.S. alone is being wasted on lighting up the underbellies of birds and the undersides of clouds. And that's a lot of money that's wasted. And another soundbite is that 2008 actually represents the first year where half the world's population is going to be living in cities. And that in itself is, you know, the biggest contributor to light pollution, living in cities. So something to keep in mind when you talk to the public. Okay. Now, slide 17 gives a little bit of the type of hands-on activity that you might choose to do with your public. We have 25 kits that we have given out, and are going to be giving out the last five of those 25 that have within them two of these little maglite type flashlights, and then there's also a paper cube that we have holes in. Actually, it's a constellation of Orion on the top of the paper cube, so it becomes a little mini planetarium. On the underside, it has a little hole for one of the maglites to be put within the inside of the paper cube. And then we have a white PVC cap that we use as a shield. And as Chuck mentioned, a couple of toy figures to give the ambiance of a scene. And then in the kit, we've also given out a very good book by Bob Kralin called There Once Was a Sky Full of Stars. And this is a very good book for mostly, I'd say, grade school, perhaps up to seventh grade or so, to try to get the kids to understand light pollution, and it does it in terms of poetry and beautiful illustrations. We have a flashlight and a red balloon to cover the bulb of the flashlight to kind of demonstrate to the public what you can do to keep your eyes dark adapted. We have a couple of batteries for that flashlight, and a DVD called Saving the Night with a narration by David Levy. And also a Globe at Night poster, as well as about 10 postcards that advertise the Globe at Night event, and more can be downloaded from the Globe at Night website. Now, to talk a little bit about what you do with the first few items on that list that I just talked about, in terms of giving a demonstration on shielding, when you take those two mag lights, you want to take off the reflectors on the mag lights and put them in what Chuck would call candle mode. And one of those are going to be the light source for the mini planetarium, and the other is going to act as a street light. And if you can imagine putting the book up in the background with a night scene of a city, that Bob Kralin's book, and then putting up the one of the mag lights as your street light, and then before you turn it on, actually turn on the one that's inside the mini planetarium and display on a low ceiling what the stars would look like to the public without any street lights. And then you could turn on the street light and notice what kind of sky you have. And then to demonstrate the shielding, you could take the cap or something else that I think Chuck's kids have used a pizza before, and then use it as a shield and notice what happens to the night sky, how it improves due to the fact that you're using some shielding. And like Chuck said, instead of having that dark area immediately around the unshielded light, you'll notice what happens to the person standing next to the street light once you cap or shield that street light, and it'll become very obvious that shielding is the way to go.
And I would like to suggest also that when you do this, you don't do this. When you're doing the shielding demonstration, make sure it's a participatory thing, because when your guest is the one that's making all the improvement with their hand or whatever it is, it can make a great impact on them when they do it themselves. what I'll do in a planetarium, for example, is we'll have this bright light, and we'll ask them, okay, what do you see? What's the problem with this? Asking these questions, okay, well, they'll say it's in their eyes and it's really bright and they're shielding their eyes from this at night. Maybe you're outside doing some sidewalk astronomy or something. And then what if you're in your bedroom? What's this light doing to you if you're in your bedroom right now and you get to the issue of light trespass? And in your room, you'll notice the stars will not be visible on the ceiling anymore. And you might say, well, what do you notice about the stars? And the sky glow has come out. I next ask them, is this acceptable? Should we do anything about it? If so, what? And then have them be the ones to propose solutions. Because some of them will suggest things like, well, I should put some curtains up in my bedroom window. And it's like, okay, well, that's good. You know, you address the issue of light trespass, but let's look at the bigger picture here. And they'll come up with some really great ideas that gets them thinking, and it's kind of an inquiry-based learning. So I really encourage you to have them come up and propose, you know, have them put their hand over it or whatever, or shield it with a cap, and get them intimately involved in the experiment instead of, if you can, if your situation permits it.
Absolutely. Okay. I wish we could have interaction here because I'm much more comfortable with hearing feedback from people, but that's the way it is tonight, I guess. It has been a very effective demo, and unfortunately, I wish we could make it a bigger demo, but at this point in time, by making it small, we can hand it out to more people, and then they can use it as fodder for creating something that's larger that they could use, in a planetarium, for instance, if they wanted to. So slide 21, all it does here, or slide 20, I should say, is just a review. Why should we care? And it's just all the capstone items that we mentioned before, in terms of saving energy and saving money in the process. And then, you know, the safety issue with coming to a stop sign that has a message below it that says, you know, watch for cross traffic and you can't even see it. And the security issues as well in terms of overlighting and having too much glare. And the sense of well-being. The animal habitats, I could go into a whole another telecon about that. There will be an article coming out for Universe in the Classroom that will address animal habitats that Anna Hurst from ASP and I are writing. It will come out fairly soon. And then the quality of life issue that encompasses everything we've said so far, plus the issues of health. And of course, there's also the fact that we lessen the greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to global warming. And, of course, the ambiance of a wonderful starry night is preserved. So all these are reasons why, you know, we should care and reasons you can talk about with the public. And actually, even before you talk about it, do as Chuck has suggested, you know, get them to suggest some of these things. And if after a discussion with them they haven't come up with these, you can prompt them or clue them in as to the different topics we've discussed. And you'll make them advocates in the process, I'm sure.
So what can we do? A lot of it, as noted in that quote on slide 21, is just it's a lack of awareness. And you don't get a lot of resistance. There are a few people that look at you a little wacky when you say light pollution. So I suggest you come up with terminology that's going to be most comfortable for your audience and for you. But it's really just a matter of informing people and making them aware of it, and then suddenly they'll come on board. What we're proposing, one path, is to get these citizen scientists to measure the quality of their local skies and then to share the result with their community.
And so one of those paths is the Globe at Night program. It is, as you would probably guess, designed to teach about the impact of artificial lighting or light conservation, as I think was it David Field likes to say, and on the local environment, and to try to preserve the dark sky oases that are out there and minimize the ongoing loss of a dark sky night. So we have, for the last 2 years, had citizen scientists all over the world in as many as 96 countries the first year, a little bit less the second year, but a lot more observations were taken. And all they did was to look toward the constellation of Orion at this particular time of year, usually last year it was in March, where most of the world could see Orion and try to match what they saw with one of seven stellar maps that had different limiting magnitudes on them, namely magnitudes 1 through 7, although most of us, especially with an aging eye, can't see a magnitude of 7, let alone a magnitude of 6. And then with the latitude and the longitude where they were taking their measurement, they submitted their measurement online, and about 3 weeks later, resulting maps were posted online of the whole world in terms of the light pollution levels that people who submitted measurements showed. So it was an inspirational event with inspirational results, and this particular year, we're hoping now, well, the second year, I should say, we're hoping to take it, or third year, a step further, and I'll tell you more about that in a few minutes. But slide 22, let me see, am I on the right slide? No, 23 here, tells you what happened in the second year, actually. So we had this first year with the classic unaided eye observations, and then the second year, which was last year, we tried to introduce an effort to make more precise measurements by using a digital sky brightness meter called a sky quality meter made by Unihedron. And this would give you, effectively, a way of being more objective in taking measurements of the night sky. And slide, oops, I'm trying to get my bearing here. And slide 24, I wanted to go through just a few slides now and tell you first about the unaided eye part of the Globe at Night program. And then I'm going to probably turn it over to Chuck, okay, and he can tell you more about the digital or sky quality meter part of the program. So on slide 24, we have the splash or front homepage, I should say, for Globe at Night. This is very easily set up, so they give a couple of paragraphs of an introduction and then the five easy steps for being involved with the Globe at Night program and what you have to do to be involved. And then on the right-hand side, there's a little blue area which has things like the packets that teachers and families require to do the program. They have things like postcards you can download and print out for advertisements, and also a flyer that you might want to use to advertise as well. And you all are very, very familiar with, you know, how to obtain your latitude and longitude and to find Orion, but the website helps the public to be able to do this as well and gives it suggestions and explanations for all these things. So on step one, where they have the public finding latitude and longitude, they give you a site to go to that's mentioned there and suggestions of either using a GPS unit to gain your latitude and longitude, or if you don't have that, there's ways of using Google Earth to obtain your lat and long. Or another site that we kind of like is called iTouch Map, which also provides you with your latitude and longitude by zooming in on your location. And once you have that, you want to instruct your public on how to find Orion. And there's obviously various ways you can do this. Some of you would probably prefer being out there in person and getting your little green laser and kind of pointing Orion out. But if the public is home and would like to find out on the web more about how to find Orion on their own, there's the website there that they can go to do just that, and a few activities that they could do, one of which is a very, very easy activity for kids that the parents can do or the teachers can do with the kids that has a transparency with clear plastic transparencies and some glow-in-the-dark puffy paints, and they trace out Orion with something they can download from the website, and little circles of the stars. Hold, you know, let it be under a light for 45 minutes. Take it outside at arm's length, and they can actually line up all the stars in Orion. It's pointed in the right direction, obviously. And that's one. And another one that's very similar to that, Chuck can tell you about. The paper plate one, Chuck?
Yeah, one of the things is when you go outside and you're looking at Orion and you're going to be wondering, oh, do I just count the stars or do I memorize the star field or how's the kid going to do it? You might want to go out and I recommend taking something like a paper plate, something that's good and rigid and you can twist it left and right, however Orion is aligned, and draw on it what you see. Because once you then come back inside and you're looking at your computer and you're going to be looking at some star charts, you're going to be wondering, did I see those stars or not outside? Boy, I didn't notice that one just underneath the belt of Orion. So just before you even look at the star fields and the star charts, just go out and draw what you see and then bring that inside. One of the ways, it's just a link I'll briefly mention, on there's a paper plate activity where we take a star field of Orion, the main outline of Orion, and drill through a stack of plates with a drill bit so that you drill the holes of the major stars, and then you can hand out a bunch of paper plates to your audience. You can rotate the plate around so it's right aligned with Orion, however it is in your night sky at that time. Don't use the wax-coated plates. Use the real cheap ones, cheapest ones you can get, but it's a real good way to have the outlines of the few stars and then have your audience go and draw in what they see.
Mm-hmm.
There will be a link to that, I trust, that you can access from somewhere. Our hosts will take care of that, I trust. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. And so there's various ways you can go about finding Orion and for the public to find Orion. And then once they have that under their belts, no pun intended, they can go to step three, and that's basically to match the night sky to a magnitude chart. And this is something that actually Chuck was getting at. I would also advocate just taking the charts with them that they can print out from the online site and having a red light and just and kind of checking out things and turning the red light off and looking up for a while and getting dark adapted and then looking back down at the charts. That's another way of doing it as well.
Yeah, those charts, by the way, are on the teacher packet. Mm-hmm. And the charts that are on the teacher packet, when you click that, are going to be larger than the charts that you can get on the website.
Oh, absolutely.
This slide that you see right here, slide number 26, that's about the real-life size of the star charts online when you go to select them and submit them. So they're kind of small and they don't enlarge. So pre-print the teacher packet so you've got that star field with you when you're out in the field. It really helps to have something a little bit bigger.
And I would also advocate there's one particular web page that you will just kind of go, for lack of a better phrase right now, go gaga over, because it's an interactive for Orion. And what it does is that depending on your latitude, you can actually change your latitude and you can actually change the magnitude, the limiting magnitude and the orientation of Orion. And it's very interactive and it gives the public a very good idea of what they have to look for when they go outside.
And that web page is one of the Globe at Night website pages that she's referring to. It's on the site. It's not an independent page.
Correct. All right, so we are down to slide 27, and this is what the teacher packet, if you download it, part of what the teacher packet looks like, to give you an idea, and you can find it on the report page when they get that going on, the teacher packet you can get right now, but the report page will look something like it when it's up in just about 10 or so days. And then once they report, all they really have to do, as you can see here, is put in the latitude, longitude, and their reading. They put in the country if they can, and the date, obviously, the time. And you can choose your chart just by clicking on which chart it looks like. And there are other questions that are asked, but they're optional. It would be good, though, that people answered what kind of cloud cover they might have toward Orion and that sort of thing, because that does help in delineating whether an answer is good or not. And that's mostly what's put on there for the unaided eye observations. And again, these are observations between the 25th of February and the 8th of March. But we do also advocate, that's not always obvious, but we do advocate that the public tries it for more than one location if they're able to. They usually do start off in their backyards, but it's often good to go a half a mile in any direction from their house and take more measurements. What we're really trying to do is get a grid of measurements all over their city, whatever city they're in order to have a robust enough database in order to map out their city. That's what we usually end up doing. We got about a dozen really good cities last year that had, over 100 measurements in each of those cities, which told a lot about the distribution of the light pollution within those cities. Okay, so that was slide 27, and slide 28 is the last step, where they don't do anything. We do all the work, and we try to assemble all of the data that was submitted during the campaign and create a world map. Now, this world map is pretty special. It doesn't look so much like something special from that particular slide that you see, but in actuality, what we're going to be able to do with this year's data, and actually data from 2 years ago, they have something called a map viewer, where you can zoom in on any location on the Earth and see close up what that area looks like in terms of light pollution. So, for instance, before I go to the next slide, let me show you those colors are represented in that little key there to the lower left in terms of limiting magnitudes. They have limiting magnitudes 1 through 7, and the darker the site, the darker the color. Okay? And that will be found on the Analyze page of the Globe at Night website. In terms of the map viewer, which is shown on the next slide, you can take it all the way down to a resolution of about 5 miles, or maybe a little better, I think, actually, with the map viewer facility that they have on the Globe at Night website. And in terms of 2 years ago, they had a population density data you could download as well, and a map of the Earth at night from the satellites, looking down at the Earth. And these two databases, we're working with Esri, a GIS firm, this year to make that available as well, so that the kids and the adults that are interested in looking back at the databases can use that as, in some sort of capstone activity, or to even go to their city governments and say, see, we need to change a few things around here. Okay, so slide 30, we have some ancillary materials, one of which I've already mentioned, and that was the interactive tool for finding Orion and changing the latitude and magnitude in the process. There's a lot on Orion mythology and other stuff on light pollution, explanations for magnitude, just lots of different things you can do on the website, or tools you can use to help explain things to the public or refer them to those particular pages on the website. Let's see now. Where am I? Okay, and then to wrap this up here with the unaided eye version of Globe at Night, we kind of got to thinking after the first year, how can we really make this more precise for those like the amateur astronomers that might want to be more objective when they take their measurements? So we thought, how about using these wonderful portable sky quality meters that Unihedron makes? And we tried to get a little grant. We've got a tiny grant to hand them out on a limited basis to organizations like ASP with your group, the Night Sky Network. And so we wanted to make it more scientific and measure changes over time. And so one way we could do this is by using this SQM, and you see it on page 32 here. This is, would you want to say something, Chuck?
No, go ahead. I was just going to launch, but we got to keep moving along here. The sky quality meter that you have has got instructions included in it.
Yeah.
On the website, they also suggest there's, this certain repeatability, but, when you get this thing, go out and have some fun with it. Go out in the field and you'll play around with it. You do have to kind of make sure that it's adjusted for 15 or 20 minutes to the temperature, because there's a temperature sensor right beneath that.
Chuck, I asked Anthony about that. He said it's only 5 minutes.
5 minutes, okay.
Yeah.
So, spend just a few minutes so that you're not taking it in extreme temperatures. For example, if you go out from inside the house to outside in the wintertime here. It's real simple to handle. It's kind of an attractive thing. The kids can use it even. I have them do most of my stuff. All you do is you hold this thing, above your head. You want to try to be consistent in how you hold it. There's that picture where it says the SQM is easy to use, and the girl there is holding it out the moon roof there.
I recommend that you actually put it right on the edge of the moon roof, so you're consistently holding it the same way, and you'll get pretty consistent readings. You hold it directly overhead, you press the button. You might have to keep it kind of close to your ear, because if you're in a dark site, it'll be going beep, 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 and all the while it's sucking in the photons until it gets enough photons that it has sensed enough, and then it can give you a reading. So you got to wait till the beeping stops, and then you turn it down, and you you look at your number and record it. It's got this cone. I'm going to jump all the way, just to move up here, I'm going to jump all the way down to slide 34. It's kind of got this cone. Yours have got a cone of about 10, 15 degrees. Think of it as like a funnel. So you don't want to have anything above that cone. You don't want to have a tree in that area that might be either reflecting light off, the light might be reflecting off that 3-inch meter, or that tree might be blocking sky glow. So that'll affect your readings. Things to look at, and this is measuring it in magnitudes per square arc second. And I just use the term squims because, you know, who knows what the hell a magnitude per square arc second is, especially some kids. So we just say, all right, we're going to use them as squims. It's an arbitrary number. But it'll be suggestive of what's good and what's not. The darker value, you know, a darker sky will have a higher value of, like a 21, and then a brighter sky will have a lower value, and that can be confusing, so make sure you got that squared away in your head.
Can you give some examples of inside a city and outside?
Yeah, you know, so if I'm inside an urban area, it might be 16.5 or 17. I just came back from an incredibly, the darkest sky sight I've ever seen. It was 21.6, just phenomenal. So it says 22, but you know, once you get up above 21, it's subject to debate of how high it can, in theory, get. And what this is measuring everything. This is measuring the Milky Way. There's a wispy cloud that comes through. You're going to notice your sky quality meter reading is going to change. The next picture, it says what to watch out for. One night we were out there and we were getting these variable readings, and I thought the machine wasn't working. Ended up being there was an aurora. So every time the aurora would flare up, our meter reading would reflect that. So it is a fairly reliable instrument. A lot of these things are just obvious about, you know, avoiding streetlights in buildings. You know, when cars are driving by, I pause. Speeding along here, you're going to want to have the basic input on the data, such as the sky quality meter serial number. You get that by punching the button a few more times. Basics like your latitude, your longitude, the meter reading, and then have a few comments. The comments will help down the road when the next person goes to do it. Say I was at this intersection standing by the stop sign or something like that, or but give something so that the next person can come along and use your data and compare it to that. We've got a couple forms there. We'll get you a different sample form, I believe, for Globe at Night, but you can see how detailed you want. And all of you should have a clear sky clock near your community. They're very valuable. Play around, go to that website, and if there's not one in your community, request a clear sky clock for your observatory or club or whatever your region is. Then once you've got this data, you can analyze it, and just to speed along here, kind of if you want to do the 39 there, how you've used it.
Oh, yeah. Well, let's give you an example of the kind of results you can get with the sky quality meter. We have plotted the sky quality meter results from our participants in Tucson, Arizona, with the population density of Tucson, Arizona. So the light pink has people up to about 2,500 per square mile, and then it goes all the way to the densest regions where it's like up to 24,000 per square mile. And that's the pink regions, the various pink colors. And then you'll see from yellow dots all the way up to dark blue, you're going from about, you know, well, actually there's an orange that goes from about 10 or 12 magnitudes per square arc second all the way up to the dark blue, which really, I don't know, but again, I agree with Chuck that I wouldn't quite trust measurements beyond 22 magnitudes per square arc second. And but that's what you have for Tucson. And as you go to your lower left, you're heading towards Kitt Peak National Observatory, and you can see the skies are getting darker away from the center of the city. So it's a very effective device, that sky quality meter. And in the following plot, it just shows the same set of sky quality meter data plotted against the Earth at night data from satellites.
And to wrap up so we can get to the Q&A,
mm-hmm.
You're on for 41, Globe at Night.
Yep. Oh, it's just an advertisement to get you guys to become the local leaders in the Globe at Night campaign. And then if you're interested in also using that as a stepping stone to the International Year of Astronomy, we have a slide, the 42, that describes how programs are progressing in terms of dark sky projects that we have for the U.S. IYA. And we're also involved with the International IYA as well.
You know, and you're going to be playing with your meter, and before Globe at Night comes, there's a couple things you could probably do. One of the things I recommend you all do is on February 20th, go out during the total lunar eclipse and practice with your meter then, before Globe, and see, you know, for example, by how much does light diminished during an eclipse, you know, the moon's natural light diminished during a total lunar eclipse. So get a little practice. You don't have to do this Globe at Night thing with a huge community effort for your first time around. If you can just get a few people to participate, you're well underway. So don't feel intimidated like it has to be a monstrous program right away. There's contact information for how to get a hold of Connie. And I believe our hosts will be stepping on right now to join us.
Thanks, you guys, so much. Connie and Chuck, that was wonderful. I learned an awful lot this evening already. So this is the time of night where you, the amateur astronomy clubs, will be able to ask questions. Now is the time to do that. We're going to talk with the operator. We know many of you are already really busy educating the public about dark skies, and we encourage you to share all of your experiences and ideas on the discussion board on the Night Sky Network website. But to save this time right now for some questions for these guys about dark skies or about Globe at Night. And so operator, is there any way you could tell us how to get in line for the questions?
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question or have a comment, please press star 1. Once again, that's star 1 for any questions or comments. You will be announced prior to asking your question. One moment, please, for our first question.
Yeah.
And our first question comes from Douglas Snyder. Your line is open.
Yes, good evening. I would like to point out to other members of this teleconference about making sure that they visit the local large retailers, sellers of lighting equipment, to make sure that they're following any local ordinances or state or county codes, because it's very imperative that they are only selling to the public fixtures that are shielded. That was
yes.
A comment.
Well, that's a very good point to bring up. We have, as one of our programs for dark skies, for the theme for the International Year of Astronomy, we have about 6 programs we're trying to put forth, and about 6 additional resources, like 6-minute podcasts and stuff like that. One of our programs is called the Great Switch Out, and we're trying to talk with manufacturers and big boxes, that's big stores and little stores, in terms of allowing people to bring in their old fixtures and get some sort of a rebate to buy a compliant fixture, which would replace the old fixture.
That was a good point, Douglas. And if your community does not have ordinances in place, as you suggested in your example, at least ask that retailer to maybe even relocate their stock or relocate their display so it does feature at least a sky-friendly model rather than just having it randomly amongst all the other fixtures.
Yes.
Thank you, Douglas.
The next question is from Larry Robinson. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm Vice President of the Orion Group in Oak Ridge. I've been an amateur astronomer since I was 10, and I'm 55, so that's 45 years. And I've watched the skies in this area get more and more and more and more pink and orange because those sodium lights that they're using, reflecting off the ground, are producing an enormous amount of sky glow right in our visual acuity range. Now, what are we going to do seriously about about the amount of reflected light, because even if you put in a full color fixture, if you've got enough light that you're still reflecting directly off the ground and illuminating the clouds, if there's any moisture in the air, even a moderate amount, you're going to wind up with sky glow anyway. What do we do about that?
Well, I one caveat is to be careful about saying it's a pink and orange problem, because then we'll just get a really bright white problem if they switch over to a different light source. And so there is some value in having the sodium lights at least being part of the problem, as opposed to just white light. Another comment on your statement is that you have noticed the difference, but a caveat with children is that they don't even know there's a problem. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to make those two points for starters. Connie, if you want to weigh in, I just had to think about another thought here.
Well, is there any, would it help also to reduce the lumens from the fixtures themselves, from the bulbs?
That's a good start, but you're talking about getting city councils who say that brilliant light is the way to go when it turns out street safety. And you get a really big city, you're getting how many thousands, dozens of thousands of those bulbs. Even a full-color fixture, you still have an enormous amount of reflected light.
Well, what the city understands is money. And they understand that saving money, well, it's a big deal to them. Is there any way of doing a study to show that if they replace with a bulb that has less lumens, that they're going to be saving money?
That's what we need to find out.
Mm-hmm.
And that has been done. There are a few examples, and I don't want to suggest a person's name right here online without confirming with that individual. I'm going to write a note of it. Mm-hmm. But I'll see if I can find that information for you. You know, one of the things that people complain about when they see that they might have to use a fully shielded light is you may have to go and have your spacing a little bit closer together. And then those people say, well, let's say I have to go and increase by 5% the number of light fixtures I have, and that's just 5% more, 10% more reflected light up. The gain that you're going to get from an increase in lights, admittedly, you're going to have a gain in reflected light, but that is vastly better than the 5% fewer light fixtures that are not fully shielded. So I would, we're not going to have everybody turn off every light, and we're not asking for it. But we got to take our gains where we can, is how I look at it. So I will tolerate literally more light poles spaced closer together. And it'll be improved, an overall improvement.
That might actually do it.
And then, another thing, if you go to some communities like, in Arizona, for example, part of it also is that if everybody has to play by the same rules, it's not so bad. If everybody has a curfew, for example, on parking lot lights, if I'm a business and my neighbor across the street's in the same business, but we both have to turn our lights off, they'll be on board for that. I want to keep my dealership illuminated, but I don't want to do it, turn my lights off at the risk of my competitor having his illuminated. But they'd love it if everybody has to have their lights off at the same time, because then they're saving big dollars, and yet there's no competitive disadvantage to doing it. So if you can have the whole area or the region of the state or whatever playing by the same rules, it's a lot easier. So there's things like curfews on lights, and timers on, if you talk to retail developments, ask them to put timers on their lights. So after a certain hour, most of the banks of lights go off. Leave a few on occasionally, but how many shoppers are there at 3 in the morning?
Bingo.
And strategies for doing all of this can be obtained through the International Dark Sky Association, which I'm sure you probably know of.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And the IDA just launched a brand new website, so be a little bit patient as they're uploading some of their resources. So thank you very much, Larry.
Larry, this is Vivian. I just wanted to add one more thing. On the discussion board under outreach ideas and activities, we've been kind of compiling a list of dark sky sites that people had information on it, and Joan Chamberlain turned us on to Saving Maui's Starry Night Skies, which is Cliff Haas's webpage. And on that webpage, it's listed on the on the discussion board. He has a lot of articles about, in particular in Maui, how light pollution weighs taxes, what exactly the specifics are of what you might want to do to convince, say, a city council to lower the lumens.
Also, the item of security is always going to come up, too. And there's studies that can go and show either way about security is improved by lighting or security is decreased by lighting. You know, one of the interesting ones is one in Chicago where they took two areas, illuminated the alleys of one area and did not illuminate them in the control area. Where they illuminated the alleys, the crime went up significantly. I don't know what it was, like 18% or something. It was a huge increase in crime. And yet even when the people were told that the crime went up, they still liked having an illuminated alley. So, you know, you're working with a long history of erroneous of perceptions that are not kind of matched up with the reality sometimes. So, thanks again, Larry.
Thank you.
The next question is from John Pasmino. Your line is open.
Hello.
Yes, John.
Yes, John Pasmino from New York Sky here in the city. Of course, we've had a light pollution situation for several centuries, and actually, we've a little blessed, but of course, also cursed. Living in New York, it's a large, humongous city, and a very, very varied development in sociology and demographics, overall the boroughs. But what we have found is we have wrapped our light pollution advocacy with the general environment, ecological, and energy conservation ethic, which is pretty strong here in the city. And for one thing, we exhibit and hand out literature and display at Earth Day. We don't do Astronomy Day. We use the Earth Day celebration, which is a giant street fair. This year it's going to be next to Grand Central Terminal in April. There you have several hundred exhibitors, including energy companies like the gas company, the electric company, the state power authority, automobile companies, and so on, as well as the small grassroots outfits. And the attendance is pretty good. You know, we get about 100,000 to 200,000 people visiting. The idea of reducing excess illumination as well as excess energy consumption is actually pretty good. The other attack is to use or to speak with the developers or architects of new large-scale projects. Hudson Yards, I don't know if you're familiar with that, but in any case, it's a empty, well, not empty, but it's a rail yard on the west side of Manhattan, over which a platform will be built, so it will be covered and underground. And then on top of that will be built a new mini city with about half a square kilometer of floor space. Oh, I think it's 15,000 houses, apartments, and a lot of office towers and so on. And the design criteria for that was abated energy use and abated use of excess lighting.
Yes, the Earth Day suggestion, I don't think I have to comment on it. I think that's a brilliant idea, and this year Earth Day is April 22. Regarding the...
The fair is on the weekend, 18th and 19th.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. Regarding the talking to the actually developers and architects is really a key way to go, because you can talk to a few homeowners and they swap out a porch light, or you can talk to somebody who develops an entire strip mall who puts in hundreds of lights.
Yes.
One of the things I'm finding with the developers is that the developers say, oh, well, I conform to the green building standards that are put out by LEEDS, which is LEEDS.
Oh, well, I'm familiar with that, yeah.
And they'll say, so,
I can tell you a building which has a big sticker on its front door, and it's a horror show.
Yeah, so just because they say they're going to conform to LEEDS, you can still ask them not to go to just the lowest common denominator. Tell them to step up, and if they're going to do something that's actually going to be true to their policy of being night sky friendly or earth friendly, to go all the way. Don't go halfway. Don't go and put all these nice parking lots in and then go have a bunch of uplighting and wall wash. to me, that represents lack of imagination by the architect or the designer. And I don't mean to insult those architects, but I try to suggest that I think that they have more imagination than to take this easy route out. So, thank you, John, very much. Appreciate your comments.
Okay, fortunately in the city, a development, whether it's an office tower or a residence estate, does not have parking lots. Either some indoor parking, maybe like 5 or 10% of the units in it, or it's located near mass transit. So we don't have the parking lot problem.
Thanks, John. We're going to have to take some more questions now.
Go ahead.
The next question comes from Alice View. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Alice View from the Tacoma Astronomical Society, and I'll make it quick. Really appreciate what you've done at Globe at Night. We've been doing it with Girl Scout troops out at camp and then having the girls repeat the process when they get home, and that's been an interesting process. And the timing is really nice for Washington State because we have House Bill 2534 right now, which is a light pollution bill. And so we're looking at this as a great tool, one, to get into the hands of the public so they can actually step outside and look around, and then pairing it up with, you know, the names of their legislatures that they can talk to about the bill after they've had a chance to kind of see things. Any suggestions for getting this into the school system more easily or more favorably with administration?
Today, I am the planetarium director in the Mishawaka Public Schools. I'm sorry, in the Penn Harris Madison school district near Mishawaka. He and I sat down with the assistant superintendent and proposed a program for 2009. You've got to look far in advance. 2008 is going to be a good chance for everybody that's listening tonight to practice with these meters, to try out with some small groups. Your program that you implement doesn't have to be polished. You're going to be participating with the Globe at Night. Get out and try Globe at Night. You've got to try it so you see what a few of the hurdles are. Then plan for 2009. You're going to be tying into an international endeavor. And what we said is that a couple weeks ago, the United Nations General Assembly declared 2009 the International Year of Astronomy. We want to have a grassroots component that dovetails with this international celebration and this international effort to bring sciences into the classrooms through astronomy. We put together a program in which we're going to have, we propose, this is just one suggestion. We're going to have an introduction to the students, in the planetarium at least, to lighting issues with these demonstrations. And with the same resources you have in your hands right now, that book, There Once Was a Sky Full of Stars, and the unshielded and shielded light demonstration. And then we're going to ask from grades 3 to 8 to go out and take an observation. But in all my experience of using this SQM, and only the 2 years that they've been around, so don't let me exaggerate too much, the biggest issue is having support from the top. You've got to have whoever is your troop leader participating instead of just being a passive observer. You have to have, in our school district, we're going to be meeting with all the school principals independently, and then we're going to be going into each one of 13 schools and talking to each one of the school staffs. Because otherwise you are doing all the work, and it's really, really hard. But I really suggest that you propose a complete program that shows how you're addressing the school standards, how the kids are going to, your whole program has to have how you're going to evaluate whether you succeed or not in this thing. And so it's not just a wishful thinking thing, but I really suggest you propose the whole ball of wax, a program where they go out.
In Tucson,
is that sounding realistic to you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In Tucson, too, we have to address the school boards for the different districts, but the real way it gets implemented is by going to each district and meeting with, at the beginning of the school year or whenever, with the science facilitators that are represented there for each of the schools in whichever district you go to. And by giving them sort of a hands-on mini workshop on what you have in mind and how it addresses the standards, then you've got them. You know, you've given them the tools, you've given them the reasons why they should be involved, and you've given them the connection to the standards.
And one of the things we had to emphasize today was that what we're proposing is not going to be another add-on project, which is going to be one more burden that all the teachers have to deal with. Instead, this was going to be a substitute program for some of the other astronomy stuff that they were going to be doing in the classroom, and it would still be addressing the school standards.
The standards are actually addressed in the teacher packet online at the Globe and Knight website.
So we could take those teacher packets in advance, send them to the board members for the different school districts, and then invite ourselves as well. We could have advance notice.
And with this, whether it's with your school or your scouts or just a couple of students, I've got two students in the entire school that are doing stuff with the sky quality meter. And after they do it, the real key to me, though, is there's two keys. One is to get them to go out and look up. That's all. That's my biggest objective in all of astronomy, is just to get kids outside and looking up. Everything else will follow.
We're trying to figure out what the next step is, because club-wise, we usually get about 15,000 kids that are served a year. So we're looking at, but how do we get it so that it goes on after we've passed through the classroom kind of thing.
Are you talking about observations or using the data?
Good. Thank you.
I'm sorry?
Huh?
Well, that's the other thing is that, a key is that after they've done it and they've observed it and they've analyzed it and they've looked at the Globe at Night results and they've looked at their own community, the other key is that you have to share that information. Not you have to share it, they have to share it.
Yeah.
So we're going to have kids that have to go in front of our school board. We're going to have kids that are going to go to the school district's energy conservation coordinator or whatever. I've got a page of ideas that are listed on the Nightwise website, nightwise.org. /ideas.htm, I believe, is the URL. And so they have to do something with it. The kids have to either share it in the classroom, they have to go out and make a presentation to a county council, they have to do a science fair project. People are looking for science fair ideas, and this is one of them.
And again, with the data sets, you can also do capstone activities, because there'll be, a comparison of the last 3 years with the data for an unaided eye, Globe at Night, and also the digital from the last 2 years, and then also the population densities they can compare it to, or the Earth, instead of looking up at the sky, you'd be looking down at the Earth, and there's a data set for that. So you can have them involved with making that kind of analysis with the data sets as well. What else? I have one more thing to say. Oh, yes, on our IYA website for the United States, we have a Dark Skies website, a web page, and that in itself is just starting to grow, but one of the things we have on there are plans for a forum in which kids could talk about their results if they'd like to.
Great.
Congratulations on having
out of time tonight. I'm so sorry. There are so many more questions that I want to get to, but we actually have to get going, and I have to say that it's time for the giveaway. I know, I'm so sorry. It's 7:15 now in our time, and unfortunately we have to keep going for that. But I would encourage everybody, if you're interested, please keep up this discussion on this discussion board. We'd love to hear what other people are doing. We'd love to hear questions. You have Connie's email on the second to last slide, on slide 43. If you have questions about the night sky, about the Globe at Night. I know she would be happy to help you out.
Yes.
And I thank you very much, all that are here. I do encourage you to follow up in discussions, ask those questions, even though there's going to be some silly ones that you're going to be embarrassed to ask, but go ahead and bring them up, and we can address them, and we'll all benefit from them. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you guys so much. It's been really an enjoyable evening. I appreciate it. I know everybody else does, too. So now is the time for the giveaway, what some of you have been waiting for. I know Globe at Night has already given away 20 of the kits, and now we're going to give away 5 more. So the kits, just to remind you, they include the sky quality meter and the demonstration that we did earlier, as well as books and other things. These kits are available to clubs who have not already won one this year. So if you're not sure whether or not your club has won a kit, please go to the last slide on slide 44 of Connie and Chuck's presentation, and those are the clubs that have won already. So if you did win, please don't call in for this. And after that, if I could get the operator to help me out, we're going to clear out the lines and start over and take the, let's do the first 5
odd number caller. So that's 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9. Operator, could you help us out with that?
Thank you.
Star one.
Please press star one. Okay, and number one looks like Christian Brugman. Your line is open.
Where are you calling from?
Calling from Oklahoma City, from the Oklahoma City Astronomy Club.
All right.
All right. Congratulations.
And the next one is Richard Norman.
Howdy.
Hey, Richard. What
I'm with the Von Braun Astronomical Society. I'm the Dark Sky Rep.
Oh, excellent.
What's the name of the club?
We're also a government employee, so I recommend that we really stress getting these green ordinances and, like, the LEEDs thing pushed through so they include outdoor lighting. Right now, they don't really address it.
Yeah.
Really.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And the next person is Bill McFadden.
Hi.
Hi. Hey, Bill, you want to tell everybody where you're calling from?
I'm from the Statesboro Astronomy Club in Georgia.
Great.
Hey, Bill. Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Okay, and the next one is Rachel Peters.
Hi.
Hi, Rachel. Where are you calling from?
Davis, California, with the UC Davis Astronomy Club.
Excellent.
Rachel, good to hear from you. This is Marnie.
Hi.
Great. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And our fifth winner is Joan Chamberlain.
Ooh.
All right, Joan.
Yay.
Congratulations. Do you want to tell everybody where you're calling in from?
Astronomical Society of Northern New England in Maine.
Great.
Hi. Congratulations, Joan.
Congratulations to everyone. So those will be sent out in the next week or so. Is that correct, Connie?
Yes.
Wonderful. And I will send those. I'll make sure to get Connie the information about where the toolkits are sent to your club. So that's where you should be expecting that.
Well, thank you, everybody. And if you have any questions, please do not hesitate to call. And I will be continually looking at the forum to see what kind of conversations are happening, and add my 2 cents in, if it's all right, every now and then.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much. Have a wonderful night, and enjoy the eclipse.
Yes, stay in the dark.
This concludes the call. You may disconnect at this time. Thank you.